And our final case for this morning is number 073009, Lopez versus Thurmer.
May it please the court, my name is Colleen Ball and I represent the appellant Julian Lopez. The central question in this case is whether the security measures that the government used at a jury view undermined the presumption of innocence at Mr. Lopez's trial. Now, cases like Allen, Estelle, and Holbrook explain that a defendant has a constitutional right to have his guilt or innocence determined at trial based solely on the evidence presented at trial. And therefore, the government cannot compel a defendant to stand trial in a condition such as wearing visible shackles or in a prison uniform or isolated and surrounded by a security force. That type of government practice undermines the presumption of innocence. And in this case, the security restraints that the state used are exactly the type of restraints that would undermine the presumption of innocence as identified by the Holbrook court.
Well, I was just one preliminary thing. What was he wearing, and was he at all shackled or whatever during these views?
Your Honor, I know the answer to that question, but it's not in the record.
Oh, dear.
So what the record tells us and what this case is all about is the fact that when he appeared at the jury view, he was isolated and he was surrounded by a fully uniformed SWAT team carrying assault weapons, and one of the guards with him had his weapon drawn while the jury walked by.
See, it would make a difference to me just to know, is he like he is in the courtroom, not shackled and wearing civilian clothes, as opposed to being shackled. Obviously, if he's not inhibited in any way, there may be some reason to surround him. If he's all tied up, then that would be lessened. But if it's not in the record...
No, it's that what the decision made in this case was based exclusively on the show of force vis-a-vis the security personnel around him. And
right.
So we're talking about a Holbrook-like situation as opposed to an Allen-type situation. However, I would point out that physical restraints could be shackles. Physical restraints can be a security force. Could be a combination of the two, but a security force alone could also violate the Constitution.
Do we have any idea why he was required to attend the jury view, even though he had the protection of the Wisconsin statute that said he did not, and indeed on two of the instances he had asserted that right?
That is exactly one of the critical points in this case, Your Honor. He was compelled to attend that jury view, and the reason that it happened initially is because no one had notice of the type of security forces that were going to be used. Neither the trial court nor the district attorney, based on this record, and certainly not Mr. Lopez or his counsel, knew that when they arrived at the view, there would be a SWAT team there and FBI agents armed and standing atop rooftops. Because that lack of notice is a form of compulsion here. It deprived him of an opportunity to object and say that degree of security isn't necessary. It deprived him of an opportunity to say, no, I don't want to participate. Or it deprived him of an opportunity to say, whoa, if that's going to be the nature of the security, I'll just observe from the van. All those sorts of options. And then, of course, we get to the view, and you're right, Your Honor, once he's there and he sees the security forces, he wants to remain inside the van.
Was it the first two stops that he stayed in the van?
It was the first stop, which was the Super America that they visited. But he was forced out of the van at the scene of the actual crime scene where Mr. Davis was killed.
Did the trial court give any reason?
Not based on this record. What we have here in terms of why he was forced out, that was an offer of proof made on a post-conviction motion where I believe it was both Mr. Lopez and his defense counsel said he wanted to remain inside the van, and the security guards told him that the court was ordering him out. So that's the extent that we have of it.
Now, the trial judge who presided over that post-conviction hearing, was it the same judge who had presided over the trial?
I don't remember off the top of my head, Your Honor.
But we have nothing in the record that indicates that the trial court, what the trial court gave as its reason for requiring his presence despite the statute.
That's right. We do not know.
And there is the possibility, although it's speculation, but there is the possibility that the trial judge never said anything, that the guards just decided he was going to be present.
It's a possibility, but either way, it's the state forcing him out in front of the jury in
those
conditions.
Well, I raise that possibility because one of the things we worry about in these cases is whether or not the law enforcement authorities staging a show of force. This has been a problem in other cases we've had, in effect, contributing to the prosecution of the defendant. That's why I asked.
Yeah, I would agree that's a possibility.
Well, the state statute confers upon the defendant the right to attend a jury view, and so that's essentially the default position in Wisconsin for purposes of jury view issues, but the record reflects that he was never given the opportunity to opt out and to waive that right.
Exactly. He also has the statutory right to voluntarily absent himself, and he was not given an opportunity to exercise that right.
Is this at the outset, because I have another question that may not be in the record either. Did his counsel object to having a jury view at all?
I don't believe his counsel objected to a jury view.
Okay. I don't know how often that's done. This counsel here says that, here's what he says, this is on page 24, I think it's very important for my client to make that jury view, and I know we tried to accommodate it as well as possible, but I've been to other jury views where a client walks with two other deputies on his side in regular deputy-type uniforms, etc. Apparently this is not unusual to have a jury view in a criminal case.
Well, we have at least two instances, this one and the Coulthard case, which is also cited in the briefs, where in Wisconsin, jury view in a criminal case. And the Coulthard case is instructive because the proper procedures were followed there. There was notice in advance to the defendant, okay, you can attend the view, but it's going to be on these conditions. This is what the security is going to be. And the defendant didn't like it, and so he was given the option to opt out. That's what should have happened in this case, but it didn't.
You know, this is not an ineffective assistance of counsel case.
No.
About what the counsel should or shouldn't have
no,
done.
No, this is not an ineffective.
So we're looking at just straightly at the statute.
Right.
Ms. Paul, did counsel accompany the defendant on the jury?
At the jury view, all the same players were there that would be at the trial. We had the defense, we had the prosecution, we had the jury who would decide guilt or innocence, and we had the judge, and the judge was instructing the jury along the way.
Your argument is basically that the jury view is an extension of the courtroom.
Yes, in the sense that it is a court-ordered proceeding, and this was court-ordered and court-conducted, and it happened partway through the trial. I mean, all we were missing were the four walls of the courtroom here.
And procedurally, it takes place following opening instructions and opening statements.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But before the evidentiary phase begins.
Exactly.
And it is not considered evidence.
That's right. Under Wisconsin law, there may be some question about that in other states, but under Wisconsin law, what the jury is seeing there is something to assist them in weighing the evidence.
All of the locations on this view, and it's my understanding there were multiple sites.
Yes.
Were they all exterior locations, or were there any interior inside of building locations?
I'm not sure. I think the answer is that they were all exterior locations. Okay. I'm into my rebuttal time, so I will stop right now. Thank you.
Mr. Weinstein.
May it please the Court, my name is Warren Weinstein. I'm an Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, and I represent Michael Thurmer, the custodian. This is a habeas case, and moreover, the certificate of appealability in this case does not address whether or not the defendant was compelled to attend the jury views. That was not a claim that the district court addressed. And it was not a claim that was raised in the state courts. The sole question before this court under the certificate of appealability is whether the show of force at the jury view violated due process. That's what's before the court. While all of those things about his arguments of compulsion and so on are interesting, they're simply not in this case. What's in this case is whether or not there's any established federal law under the U.S. Supreme Court precedent to require habeas relief in a jury view that's outside of the courtroom. Now, it kind of depends, as Samuels teaches us, a case that was decided a couple months ago by this court, how narrow we view the established federal law question under 2254 D1. If you consider it narrowly, i.e. the holdings of these cases, clearly Lopez doesn't fall within the holdings of any of these cases, because Allen dealt with shackles in the courtroom, Estelle dealt with prison garb in the courtroom, and neither of those things happened here. Holbrook deals with security in the courtroom. That's really the closest case, but it certainly doesn't deal with security outside of the courtroom.
Do any of those cases contain any language which would indicate that the rationale of the case is limited to the courtroom as opposed to any other part of the judicial proceeding that might be held at another location?
Well, in the sense that the Holbrook case sets forth very broad principles that can be weighed outside of the courtroom, the answer is yes. But, of course, when you begin that weight, then being outside the courtroom suggests a different calculus than inside the courtroom, because the security procedures are heightened outside of the courtroom. The chance of escape is greater. And in this case, of course, when there was a threat of killing witnesses, police officers, who knows, defendant himself.
This may certainly change the balance of factors which the trial judge must weigh. But why does it change the methodology the trial judge must employ?
It doesn't change the methodology.
Well, then it does not?
No, but the methodology is very broad.
But then you're saying that the Court of Appeals of Wisconsin was wrong.
No, I'm not.
Because they
did the balance.
Please, sir, just a minute. Because the Court of Appeals of Wisconsin apparently took the position that it was the judgment of the sheriff and not the trial judge which was to decide the level of security outside of the courtroom.
And there's no Supreme Court case that says otherwise. So that factor may well be correct.
In other words,
moreover, the court did balance all of the factors. There is simply no federal law that says the court can dictate security outside of the courtroom. There's Wisconsin case law to the contrary, as a matter of fact. There's a specific case in Wisconsin dealing with transportation of the prisoner from the place of confinement to the courtroom that indicates that it's the sheriff who decides. So I disagree whether or not the trial judge abdicated or not. The Court of Appeals weighed the factors, and that's the decision this court has to address. If there are no further questions.
Apparently not.
Most of the problem is it's not on the record. And that's my dilemma, because about whether or not there were objections before to go out on in a jury.
There were apparently no objections to the court view itself.
Okay, and so now once they're out, then I guess it's a question of who's in charge and to what extent can they do this.
It's true the record could be better in this case, but what happened was when they returned from the jury view, defense counsel made a motion to dismiss the charge, and the court and the attorneys apparently agreed on what had happened at the jury view. I say apparently because apparently Ms. Ball disagrees with that. Nevertheless, the Court of Appeals determined that the underlying facts were not in dispute. And there is no dispute that there were four armed guards and that they did have body armor, and I don't know, it wasn't specifically referred to as a SWAT team, but those facts are undisputed. But exactly whether he objected to the view, he didn't object to the view in a broad sense. He apparently didn't want to get out of the van, but the record's pretty sparse on that.
Thank you. Ms. Ball, you've got 1 minute left.
Your Honor, I'd like to start by, talking about what happened. Everybody agrees what happened. When they returned from the view, defense counsel stated on the record what happened. The judge was there. District attorney was there. Nobody objected with his statement as to what the security personnel, what that situation was like at the view. I would also like to point out that, Your Honor, Judge Mannion, your concern about who's in charge once we're outside the courtroom.
That's cases, all of our concern. That's not just mine.
Cases like Estelle teach that it is the trial court's constitutional obligation to implement the presumption of innocence. And so in this particular case, when the court is the one that's ordering the jury view, then the court is the one that has to balance the question of the presumption of innocence versus the type of security that would be needed out at the view. And it has to make that decision up front so that the defendant has a notice, opportunity to be heard, to object, to make his statutory decision to attend or to not attend the jury view. I see my time is up.
Thank you very much. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And that concludes our calendar today. The court is in recess until next month.